Welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast with Anne Fairpo, brought to you in association with CCH, part of Wolters Kluwer, number one in tax and accounting worldwide.
Hello and welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast for Monday the 12th of November. Main points that I want to cover off today: SDLT case that's been upheld by the Upper Tribunal, VAT flat rate and backdating, do's and don'ts, and lump sum payments for motor expenses, whether or not they are earnings for NIC purposes. So to start with the SDLT case, Vardy may have lost, but an SDLT scheme that actually worked is still working. This was the sale of the old Dickens and Jones store on Regent Street, and sale was 6 years ago. As a result of some nifty footwork with a subsale to a corporate partnership, the 2.6 million or so of SDLT that might have been payable on the transaction was not, according to the First Tier Tribunal in February last year. The case is DV3RS, by the way. And the Upper Tier Tribunal has agreed that it was not payable. In a nutshell, the argument was that under the subsale provisions in Finance Act 2003, the first transaction, from the vendor to a company, was disregarded, and SDLT was instead charged on the consideration paid by the subsale transferee for the original transfer and the subsale rights together. But, under the transfer of interest rules in a partnership, the consideration of the transfer of an interest from a partner to the partnership is nil where the partners are all connected, as they were here. So, as a result, on this one, the SDLT was nil. HMRC were trying out various arguments of the Upper Tribunal, as they had done at the First Tier Tribunal, including a claim that the transfer under the subsale was by the original vendor and not by the company, on the grounds that the subsale rules ignore the transfer to the company, and on that basis the partnership rules shouldn't apply. The reasoning of the Upper Tribunal is a little different to that of the First Tier Tribunal, although the end answer is the same. The key point arising out of this was that the Upper Tribunal confirmed that the disregard transfer to the company is only a disregard for SDLT purposes. It has a limited nature and purpose. It doesn't change reality. It simply disapplies the SDLT consequences. As a result, the transfer under the subsale was by the company and the partnership rules did apply. The judge noted that the subsale by the company to the partnership forms part of the real state of affairs, and I can find nothing in the statutory hypothesis which would require it to be displaced. Basically, he was saying the subsale rules create a hypothetical or fictional contract, and they don't affect reality. He finished by saying that this result is no doubt one which Parliament would not consciously have intended had the facts of the present case been drawn to its attention. But, in respectful agreement with the First Tier Tribunal, he considered that this was the result which followed from a proper construction of the relevant statutory provisions and their application to the undisputed facts. In other words, if it works, it works, even if it wasn't what was intended by Parliament. This could be an interesting reminder given the current press hoopla about tax payments by multinationals, although increasingly press coverage seems to be ignoring what is intended as well as what wasn't intended. It seems to be targeting previously unknown avoidance mechanisms such as plain vanilla capital allowances, as the latest one I've seen, where I'm pretty sure the law does actually seem to be doing what was intended when you claim capital allowances on normal capital expenditure. On this one, back to SDLT, I must remind you that Section 75A of the Finance Act 2003 was introduced a few months after this transaction took place, and the SDLT rules for partnerships have also been revised, so this scheme wouldn't work now. This was also picked up in tribunal, where it made clear that this actually only worked for a relatively short period of time, just a few months. Next case up is on VAT flat rate. This is a quick reminder of VAT flat rate and backdating as a result of somebody getting it rather wrong. The flat rate scheme can be used by small businesses and allows them to pay VAT on a mechanical formula. It's just a reminder for background. Instead of comparing output and input tax, they just apply the formula to their turnover. Percentage used depends on the type of business, and once agreed, that percentage is applied to the VAT-inclusive turnover. In some cases, this can work quite well. For example, on a labour-only business such as, a writer on legal matters with very little in the way of supplies to purchase, or where the costs have no VAT, such as on travel. Speaking hypothetically, of course. If the percentage is relatively low, such as the 12% any other activity rate, it can actually work in the business's favour. 12% of 120% is 14.4, rather than the near 20% which would otherwise have to be accounted for to HMRC. To come back to this case, on application to use the flat rate scheme, HMRC will generally allow the business to start using the scheme from the beginning of the VAT period after which HMRC have processed the application. You can request an earlier start date. HMRC will consider the request, although they note in VAT Notice 733 that they will not usually allow a taxpayer to go back and use the scheme for periods for which the VAT liability has already been calculated. They will quite readily agree to backdate to the beginning of the current period, for example, certainly in my experience. All of this makes the Lenny case, which was recently heard in the First Tier Tax Tribunal, a little startling. The taxpayers applied to join the flat rate scheme at the end of February 2009. This was agreed by HMRC shortly afterwards in March 2009. So far, so good. A year and a half later, though, in October 2010, the accountants wrote to HMRC asking for the flat rate registration to be backdated, apparently to sometime in 2008. The judgment doesn't say exactly. That seems a somewhat optimistic request, and so it proved. HMRC flatly refused. The judgment then adds a little more detail, which makes the request even more optimistic and does make one wonder just a little about the background. Apparently, the taxpayers are being pursued for an amount of VAT, unpaid VAT, by HMRC for 2008, an amount which would be eliminated if their application for flat rate was backdated. The appeal against refusal to backdate is a quasi-judicial review appeal, but the tribunal do have the ability to hear it. The test is whether HMRC could not reasonably have come to the decision to which it in fact came. The refusal to allow the appeal here isn't surprising. If you want to backdate a flat rate scheme application, it should be done as part of the application process, not months or years later. And to round out the trip through the courts, next we're going to look at lump sum payments for motor expenses in the Court of Appeal. We've heard from the Upper Tribunal and the First Tier Tribunal, now we get up to the rarefied heights. The learned judges there have overturned a decision of the Upper Tribunal, which had overturned a decision of the First Tier Tribunal. There's something of a legal merry-go-round. By way of background, before the scenic tour through the courts, this was a case where a taxpayer, Total People, now Cheshire Staff Development, paid its staff motoring expenses. For those members of staff who travelled less than 2,500 miles a year, the expenses were paid using HMRC-approved rates, which were then 40p and now 45p. Those staff members who travelled more than that got a lump sum of £3,600 per year, although paid in 12 monthly instalments, plus 12p a mile, which was later increased to 13p a mile. Many businesses use this sort of scheme, and the idea behind it quite often is to assist employees in buying cars by helping with monthly payments to minimise the risk that they turn up at clients in an old banger, which may not reflect on the company the way they wish it to. It may also stop creatively routed trips to add mileage to increase payments where a higher mileage rate only is paid, for example. There's no particular suggestion that was the case here. It was no background really discussed. The company had accounted for national insurance contributions on the excess lump sum payments, that is, the amounts over the HMRC mileage rates on actual mileage done at first. But then they came to the view that this wasn't correct, and so the tour of the courts started because they claimed a repayment of the national insurance contributions paid in error. This is usually a surefire way to get HMRC's attention. Basically, the Court of Appeal decided that the First Tier Tribunal's legal reasoning was correct. Remember, you can't appeal on questions of fact, only questions of law, so this at each stage, at the Upper Tribunal stage and the Court of Appeal stage, has been looking at the question of what the law is in this. Now, the judgment of the Court of Appeal is a little underwhelmed by the advocates in both First Tier and Upper Tribunal. One of those was an advocate before the Court of Appeal. Ouch! He was acting for HMRC, by the way. The judges in the Court of Appeal didn't much like the lack of case law cited at First Tier Tribunal, or the failure, in both cases, to refer to relevant law, and the resulting muddle. The judges in the Court of Appeal dusted the case off, turned it around, smartened it up, and handed it back to the advocates with a bit of a telling off and saying, effectively, see, that's what you should have done. It's always useful to follow the advice of the Court of Appeal on these matters, by the way. They generally know what they're talking about. There's a fair bit of firepower involved with this one, with Mummery, Atherton and Sedley sitting. Not that the Court of Appeal bench lacks intellectual firepower in general, it must be said. In addition, though, at the end of the judgment is an extremely useful summary of the principles that need to be considered where an employer establishes a general scheme for reimbursement of employees' travelling expenditure. The principles are used in order to determine whether the allowances should be treated as taxable earnings of the employees because they involve a profit element, or whether they should be ignored because they are reimbursement of expenditure. The principles are that 1. A broad brush approach is necessary in view of the practical constraints of devising a scheme that can apply to a number of different employees and is administratively workable. 2. The test is not whether the allowance produces a mathematical equivalence with the expenditure, but 3. Instead, the test is whether the scheme was constructed in a genuine endeavour to produce an equivalence between the allowance and the expenditure and to apply with approximately equal justice to all within scope. These principles were actually set out some time ago in a case called Donnelly. HMRC rather wildly had tried to argue at the first upper tribunal that first tier tribunal had failed to address these principles. Well, as Justice Sedley pointed out in the Court of Appeal, neither side had cited Donnelly, from which these principles are derived, and you can't expect the tribunal to apply a test that you don't put to them. This isn't France. The Court of Appeal didn't say this, by the way, this is my extrapolation. We don't have an inquisitorial judicial system. The judges aren't supposed to go off and decide for themselves what the real answers should be. They're supposed to derive it from what's put to them by the advocates. Now, in specialist tribunals such as tax, you may end up with a qualified judge who actually knows what you're talking about and may be able to bring in the principles, etc. But you can't rely on this. They may not have any knowledge in that particular area and will be relying on the advocates to get the law right instead. For HMRC in this case to complain that the tribunal hadn't considered a principle which HMRC's advocate hadn't put to them is a bit disingenuous. But the practical end result is that the Court of Appeal has agreed the scheme was a bona fide scheme, that the lump sum element was designed precisely in order to prevent staff making a personal profit by maximising their travel on a 40p a mile basis, and that the scheme was designed with a view to administrative convenience. As a result, the lump sum payments were not earnings, so these sorts of mileage schemes seem to be safe, well, at least for now anyway. Coming on to the snippets, first up, the interim GAR panel. There are going to be no HMRC people in it. This is an advisory panel being set up to give opinions on specific cases and to approve HMRC guidance on the GAR. The original plan, in the consultation document published in June, was for HMRC to actually be represented on the panel. In a victory for consultation respondents, this is no longer the case. HMRC will not have a staff member on the panel, although they will have some indirect influence. They'll appoint the chair of the panel and will need to do so by January 2013. And that chair will advise on the appointment of other members. In the meantime, Graham Aaronson, by the way, continues as the chair of the interim advisory group, developing draft HMRC guidance, which is due for publication in December, presumably with the finance bill. Next snippet is on shadow ACT, which is a tax concept that refuses to die. A draft statutory instrument has been published to bring the UK into line with EU law on how you deal with ACT. This is 13 years after ACT was abolished. For those of you who don't remember ACT, once upon a time, before April 1999 to be exact, a company that made a distribution to shareholders was required to pay advanced corporation tax, ACT. It could then usually offset this advanced tax against actual corporation tax that was payable for that accounting period. Unused ACT, where you had a mismatch between distributable profits and taxable profits, could be carried forward and used in subsequent accounting periods. Companies are actually still allowed to use their carried forward ACT against corporation tax even now, if they still have some floating around this far down the line. What we have now as a consequence is a concept of shadow ACT on a distribution. You have to calculate the shadow ACT when you make a distribution, and you are only allowed to deduct carried forward ACT in excess of the shadow ACT against corporation tax. The rules are still around, as I say, for companies that have this stuff. The draft regulations have been put in place because those rules don't apply where you've got a UK parent. You don't have to calculate shadow ACT, so you don't have so much of a restriction on the carried forward ACT that you can use. It's not the case with the EU parent companies, though, and the EU don't like it, hence the draft regulations. It'd be quite nice if HMRC were quite so responsive in other areas of tax where there are EU problems, such as exit taxes, perhaps. Next, patent box. At very long last, the Treasury have published the draft order bringing certain European patents into the scope of the patent box. It was trailed in a technical note in December last year. Qualifying countries are Austria, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, Germany, Hungary, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Slovakia and Sweden. That mini Eurovision Song Contest, broadly, is the list of countries that have patent scrutiny processes that are reasonably similar to those of the UK and the European Patent Office. If you want to use a patent other than a UK patent or a European patent, these are the ones to go for. If you're desperate to have a French, Spanish or Italian patent, you'll have to get a European patent granted by the European Patent Office and validated in one of those countries. Or just get a UK patent as well. All that's actually needed is that you have a qualifying patent. You can have as many non-qualifying patents on the thing as you like, provided the product is actually covered by a UK or EPO or other qualifying patent, then the worldwide income from sales of that product will qualify. And finally, just a sort of quick note, victory possibly not for democracy, the employee owner shares arrangements. The consultation had ended. It ended 2 days after the second reading of the bill putting the rules into place. This is ridiculous. On which note, this is the end for this week, and hope you all have a good week, and I'll speak to you next time.